let's jump to a scenario that we see a lot, I'm sure all of us see a lot, which is the patients that come in, they have some blurry vision, they're not seeing well, they've been told they have a cataract, but they also have significant dry eye. Dr. Nichols, like, how are you managing those patients? And let's just imagine this is a patient that's kind of a little type A and they really want to get through their surgery ASAP, but they've seen you for advice on how they can optimize their ocular surface as fast as possible so they can go back to see their cataract surgeon.
Wouldn't that be great if a patient came in saying, I'd like you to optimize my ocular surface so that I can get my cataract surgery? But, you know, I think, you know, ideally they get taken care of wherever they come from. So in the referring optometrist office or the ophthalmologist practice that, you know, that we're either all, you know, together, that it's managed ahead of time before they're evaluated for cataract. But oftentimes, you know, we don't have that luxury. And so then the question is whether or not you slow down, you know, their surgical date, or if you can do it within the number of weeks it might take for them to actually get to the point of having the surgery. So, you know, there's the ideal and the real there. Certainly you might not have the time to do a long acting anti-inflammatory if they're going on real quickly. But I think the important part now is looking at the meibomian glands, because that probably causes as much, if not more, of an impact on, because it's the lipid layer that's the outermost layer that is what really is the refractive surface of the eye. So if you can sort of normalize the meibomian glands to some degree before cataract surgery or any surgery for that matter, you have a better chance, I think, of having a good outcome. So that's a good approach. And there are shorter versions of that, depending on what kind of practice you are. I would love to send them all to Dr. Breimer's practice so that she could take care of all of them before they go on to cataract surgery. But it's important to look and be thinking, and our message should be to tell everybody as often as we can to look, because that patient comes in saying that they have blurred vision. They aren't talking at all about any dry symptoms. They are focused on getting their vision fixed, even if they have dry eyes. So unless you're really looking, you do miss it. They are an asymptomatic dry eye patient for the most part.
Absolutely. Those are such great points. And just to share, Dr. Nichols, I'm a big fan of using hypochlorous acid spray for my patients prior to cataract surgery. Not only does it help MGD, but also I hope, I don't know if it does, but it reduces at least the bacteria around the eyelid. So hopefully that reduces the risk for infection. Obviously there's no clinical trial that's shown that, but theoretically that's my hope. But thank you so much. That was such a great thought process on how we help our patients with cataracts that aren't seeing well. Let me ask Dr. Breimer, for patients that are coming in for refractive surgery, I'm sure that's happened. They've gotten at least a consult, told they are a candidate in some ways, but they're dry is too terrible to consider LASIK right away. How do you manage those patients? And again, imagine they're a little bit anxious to try to have surgery.
So are they ruled out indefinitely, or they've been sent back to rehab?
right. The doctor says you're a perfect pentacam, perfect, you're a minus four, you're gonna be the perfect patient, but your dry is just not, the tears aren't working. I want you to see an expert because I'm too busy to manage this. I know this great expert in dry eye, and you're going to go right to her practice and she's going to fix you up ASAP.
So you're talking to a woman who has a huge portion of my dry eye practice is post-LASIK patients. You realize that, right? So I'm probably not going to steer them that direction, but no, I'm not against it. But if somebody, I mean, let's be honest, if somebody has dry eye that puts them on the fence of being a candidate for LASIK, it's probably not a good long-term decision. And we know that now. So hopefully we're really being discerning in who we allow to pursue that. But if I were trying and really giving them the benefit of the doubt and talking them through both sides, it would probably be procedure-based. You know, looking at like what we've said all along, what's the underlying cause? And the way that I speak to them about this is, okay, we've got a boat, there's four holes in there. We've got to plug each and every hole, which means we've got to treat them simultaneously or you're still going down, you know? And if we come back and we're not winning in a category, then we go up to the next level and the next level of aggression. And it's not a trial and error thing with me. It's more of a, how far do we have to go? And so we add on and we trade up, but I'm not taking away something I gave them to trade it for something else. It's more of increasing the aggression and adding to.
No, I love that. That's a great point. And guess what? based on your comments, we're going to switch the patient from LASIK to an ICL procedure to avoid any disruption of the ocular surface. I appreciate your comment there. Well, let's go to Dr. Matossian. So, I mean, everyone's put together, Dr. Matossian, so many good thoughts on how to manage these challenging cases. I guess just an overview, like, how do you actually develop your treatment algorithm? Imagine there's lots of viewers here. They're hearing so many great ideas and great thoughts, but then let's try to put it together. Like, how do you make a plan for, you know, how to manage patients? Because there are different situations, but maybe you can give it an overview on a treatment algorithm, how to start.
You know, Bill, that is so important because we want to achieve the best outcome for the patient in the shortest interval. To do that, we have to first properly diagnose, like we talked about at the beginning part of this program. And secondly, target the selected treatment to address the underlying cause. So if it's, let's say, tear surface disruption, well, you may want to look at the eyelid positions. You may want to look at the eyelid margins. Maybe they will do better with an in-office procedure to evacuate the inspissated meibomian glands. Maybe they need oral omega supplements in order to improve the viscosity and the quality of their meiba. If the inflammation is the biggest target, then maybe a short course of aggressive steroid therapy to put that fire out, as Crystal said, but maybe long-term immunosuppression and modulation via some of the products that we talked about. And often it also depends on what else is going on. Are there telangiectatic vessels? Well, if there are, maybe there is a hint of rosacea, maybe these people will do better with IPL than with a heat and evacuate in office procedure. And lastly, it depends on the patient's personality. If they are not compliant and they're not going to do anything you ask them to do religiously, day in, day out, morning, midday, evening, however often you're asking them to do it, then, you know, take the equation into your hands and do a procedure and minimize the at-home remedies you're asking them to do, because otherwise they're not going to get better.
I know that one of the things that occur a lot is that we have these great technologies, these great procedures for dry eye, and we have excellent medications. And I'm going to ask Dr. Nichols here, you know, when you have patients, they're coming in and you want to use a procedure, is how do you kind of combine the procedures with the pharmacologic therapies that we have available? Just curious how you're putting them together. Are you using both simultaneously? Or are you going to just do a procedure first, then add a pharmacologic, or vice versa? Just curious your approach.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on, you know, which, you know, what the sort of what whole ocular surface sort of system looks like if they, and what they're taking. So, you know, certainly I'm a lover of my meibomian gland dysfunction. Actually, I guess I'm a lover of it being gone, but I do, you know, I do think that, you know, most everybody has some form of MGD, and I believe in preventative treatment if at all possible. So I think regardless of what you're doing in the anti-inflammatory categories, you do need to be looking at the meibomian glands and managing that too. Now, the challenge is in the financing in some instances, and you have to be able to, you know, convince your patient this is the very best thing for them. And there are a variety of different things that, you know, people have in their offices that they can use that are in-office treatments. But I do think treating the meibomian glands is continue to be a very important part of managing ocular surface disease. And that does require, until we get approval, you know, approval codes that allow us to bill for them, it's out of pocket. And so there is a bit of, you know, students will always say, well, I don't want to have to, you know, sell something. Well, you're not. You're giving your patient the best treatment for their situation. And that's not sales. But I see where, you know, some people are afraid to recommend a procedure that costs money when they think that there may be a drop that should fix that. So I'd love to hear from the two ladies about how they've managed that, because I think it's an important point to be able to talk to your patient about that and be confident with your decisions related to how you're going to manage the patient.
Oh, that's a great question. Dr. Breimer?
It comes back to me, it comes back to that patient education piece and having the tools to just tell them their story. And in the beginning, when I first started, I would stumble over my words and I would talk it to death. And it felt like I was selling something. And I'm like, who am I trying to sell here? You or me? And then that evolved because I saw the outcomes. I saw what we could do and the changes we could make. And I had the tools to tell them their story. So it evolved into me being the messenger and just effectively helping them to see it for themselves. And as far as comparing, you know, I will sit back and I'll, one thing I do is in the very beginning when I'm setting up the day, like the exam, the eval, I try to negate the biggest pieces of baggage that I see people coming in with. So my big points are, you know, I've got a plan. We're going to go through a long list of differentials. Whatever's positive, we're going to pair it with the treatment. It won't be forever. It's just to get you stable and then we can back off. If we need more, we'll climb that ladder of aggression. I'm going to figure out what's going on. I'm going to show you everything. You're going to learn a ton. I'm going to prioritize it. And then I'm going to give you a good, better, best option. And we're going to decide together. And then everything's going to be written down. You don't have to worry about remembering a thing. And when you think about the baggage that people come in with, either they've been to a bunch of doctors and it's just going to be somebody else is going to throw something else at me, or I'm not going to understand. You're not going to talk to me. You're going to decide to sell me something instead of me being involved in the decision, or how am I going to remember this? These were what I felt like were my four biggest points that I needed to deflate the minute I walked in the door. So I think that helps with the overall conversion at the end, is to put their mind at ease so that they can be in the moment with me and listen. And then I show them their story. I show them what the pictures say. And then I give them that good, better, best so that they feel like they're a part of the decision making. But I sit back and I say, if it were me, I would do this, 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 and this. How's that sound? And 90%+ of the time, almost 95, they say, okay, because it makes sense to them. Now, one thing when I'm doing a comparison of, okay, if you don't want to do that, I can write you a prescription for a drop. Here's the difference. If we do these in-office procedures, it's going to be a quicker trajectory. We're going to get a better outcome quicker, and it's not going to be dependent on your perfection. That's the difference. When we rely on the things that you're going to do at home, I've got to give you more things to do at home. So it's going to take more time, but it's going to take diligence on your part. And when you go on vacation or somebody gets sick or you're able and just not able to do it, you're going to hurt because you didn't do your part. So it's always going to be dependent on you. And it just helps them put it in perspective that it's not the only route that we can go. We can choose a different route for you, but here's what to expect in that route versus this one. And the other thing that I like to mention is there's no guarantee that that's going to be an inexpensive route because we don't know what the copays are for the drugs. And we still need all these collateral, you know, palliative treatments that go along with it.
Dr. Bremer, that was a great approach. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's really helpful. And just, I loved how you say you actually write it out for the patients to take home and think about it. That also must be really, really helpful. One of the things that's exciting for all of us here is that, and I guess it's going to make your notes even longer, is that we have three new medications that recently got FDA approved. I'm going to ask Dr. Matosian, maybe just to do a little overview of the three new medications, because it's very exciting. This is going to add to our armamentarium, and it's going to, of course, work very nicely with our procedures as well. Dr. Matosian.
We're so fortunate that the field of dry eye disease is literally exploding. It's mushrooming with diagnostics and with different treatment modalities. The three newest ones, and they're not in any particular order, but I'm just going to list them. One is what was Novo 03. It is now called Mibo. Bausch & Lomb recently made the announcement that it is FDA approved. And what it is, it's an anhydrous product. It has no water whatsoever. Therefore, there's no osmolarity or pH associated with this product. The feel is very velvety and luxurious. There's absolutely no stinging. And it is used QID to help kind of stabilize the tear film and prevent evaporative dry eye. That's Mibo. The second one is Vevye. That's how it's pronounced, Vevye. And it is cyclosol. And recently, just a few days ago, actually, Harrow Pharmaceuticals made an announcement that they got the rights to license this product and distribute it in both the United States and Canada. What this is, it's cyclosporin mixed in with that cyclosol solution. So again, the stinging, the burning, the instillation site discomfort is eliminated, but the main ingredient is cyclosporin. The third one is Xdemvy. Xdemvy is lotilaner, and this is by Tarsus, and it is the only FDA-approved product for the treatment of blepharitis caused by Demodex mites. The studies were very robust in that the mites were actually killed, and it is used for a six-week period twice a day. If the infestation reoccurs, then the patient may be able to use it again. I mean, or is encouraged to use it again, maybe semi-annually. So those are the three new products on the market in terms of treatment options. And the newest kid on the block is the announcement was made just a few days ago. It's a new diagnostic device for IgE immunoassay, so we can differentiate allergic conjunctivitis from other red eyes. And this is a kit available with a billable code from Versea.
Oh, very nice. Now, these are all really big additions to our armamentarium. Any thoughts, Dr. Brimer, Dr. Nichols, on these three new agents? Just, I mean, I'm super excited. I'm just curious if you had any particular thoughts or what you're most excited about.
Just super excited to see the clinical trials are continuing at such a rapid pace. And look, we have three new options. Now that's going to confuse a lot of people, I think, in terms of, well, now what? There's even more, but that's great. I mean, we're going to start to see how we all use them in a stepwise approach or in addition to other, you know, without other things or in place of other things. Unfortunately, there's going to be the issues of insurance and, you know, that always is a huge barrier in the first bit of new medications coming on, but I think there'll probably be some pretty robust patient incentive plans, or not incentive plans, but patient assistance plans in the beginning to help people get, you know, to get it and get using all of these medications. So boy, let the fun begin is what I say. It's going to be exciting when they all do come to market. I mean, they're all approved, but we haven't seen them in the practice yet. So yay. Some of these, you know, I've been involved in some of the clinical trials, and we're either getting better at clinical trials or these medications are just getting better because we're just seeing some great results. That's very convincing for all of these products in terms of their FDA application. So really exciting times.